Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
The Geek here from Lexington, Kentucky.
And I am Jamie Jennings from Phoenix, Arizona, and you're listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for February 23rd, 2011, episode 83, sponsored today by Back on Track. Good morning, Horse World.
That's just his horsenality.
The mountain, she's done skiing. I don't think she has any casts, but probably a few bruises. Welcome back, Jamie.
Thank you. It's good to be back. And yes, I am bruised and battered, but I have made it. The thing is, my husband is such an awesome skier that, you know, he's one of those guys that points his skis straight down the hill and he's at the bottom, no problem. And me, I kind of have to zigzag on the hill.
You kind of meander down the hill. You're just meandering down.
Exactly. So it's I definitely ski opposite of how I ride, because the slower the better is when I'm skiing. But I fell a couple times and I've got some ski shaped bruises on my legs. And yeah, people would, like you said earlier when we were talking on the phone, don't let the doctor go to the doctor because they'll arrest your husband for abuse. That's that's pretty much what will happen right now. I'm so bruised. But that's okay. It was really fun, and we had a great time. And thanks for letting me have a couple days off.
Did you actually get to sit by the – and that was all on the bunny hill. That's the amazing part.
Huge. Actually, bunny hill my butt. I did my – okay. On purpose, Glenn, on purpose, I did my first black diamond. On purpose.
I mean, you didn't accidentally get dropped off the ski lift or, you know, you had no choice.
Usually, pretty much it was a decision that we made collectively. And usually what happens when I ski a black diamond is I'm like, oh, my God, why am I at the top of this hill? And then I start crying. So I actually did a black diamond. And I got to the very tippy top of it, and I looked down, and I could feel, like, you know, the panic and the tears start to well up in the back of my throat. And I was like, you know what? Jennings, you can either cry or attack the hill. And I decided to attack the hill, and I made it down to the bottom. Of course, you know, Chad is down there waiting for me, staring at me. So first black diamond on purpose. I loved it. It was really hard.
And, of course, he doesn't wait around to see if you're going to make it alive. He just goes down to the bottom and hopes to show up.
You know what he says? He says, I like to go down the bottom and then watch you. I'm like, that's fun. I would like it if you were behind me, so when I fell, you could come and pick me up.
Picking up the pieces on the way down.
Exactly. But thanks so much to Chrissy Joy and Helena for filling in for me on Monday and Tuesday. I wouldn't have been able to do it without them. So I really do appreciate it, guys. Thank you. And I'm sorry I made you put up with Glenn some extra time. But I guess that happens.
They were troopers. They did well. They were troopers. But it's nice to have you back. It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like you get used to doing something every morning. You have your coffee. In our case, with Jennifer and I, you know, we get up and I have my tea, she has her coffee, and then we talk to Jamie. That's what we do every morning, you know? It's kind of ruins the routine when you're not around. You'll see someday I go on vacation and you have to train your own co-hosts for a couple days.
I don't know if I could do it. But I was laughing because I'm like, I'm gone for 2 days. And I look on this Facebook page, and what do I find? The most ridiculous contraption I have ever seen. I'm completely irritated about this whole theimprinter.com thing. I actually logged on because it doesn't, you can't really tell what it is in the little picture on Facebook that you posted. However, I went and watched the video, and I was like, this is the dumbest thing I have ever seen in my entire life. And I thought for a second that you had let the imprinting people become sponsors, and I was going to be really mad.
No, and I doubt after the show yesterday and all the comments on our Facebook page that they're going to want to be sponsors either.
That's okay.
It did not get rave reviews from our listeners, that's for sure. If you're not sure what we're talking about, just go to Horses in the Morning Facebook page and scroll down a bit, and you'll see something called The Imprinter. And you can take a look at that and see what you think of it. Maybe there's somebody out there that actually thinks it's a good idea, but we haven't found that person.
I'm sorry. I went to theimprinter.com, which is where they have their little training video, and I was noticing that it's this big contraption, and you walk the horse into it, and then you secure the horse to this ridiculousness, and then you like get them. But they never actually showed them leading the horse, like an untrained horse, into this thing, because there's no stinking way. And it was just like they cut it, and the certain parts. Anyway, it was just. I was mad at you for a minute.
I knew you'd have an opinion. I was trying to hold off talking about it until today, but we ended up talking about it yesterday because I just knew you'd have a strong opinion about this particular contraption.
Well, I'm done. I'm sorry.
Let's go to Jennifer, find out what's on today's show, and then we'll chat a little bit more about your skiing and your adventures over the weekend and what's coming up.
On today's show, we will be honoring this month's Collegiate of the Month, Karen Scholl, young up-and-coming nutritional molecular science something or other. And then our extreme traveler, Kimberly Brown, will be finishing up her tales from Tanzania. Can't wait to hear about the up-close-and-personal lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my. And it's Wednesday, so thehorse.com will be here with some really interesting facts about colic. Additionally, Jamie will have a report on her supposed ski trip. Or was it really something else?
She has
it's
you,
really
she's
mysterious.
Doubting you.
I know. It's not that mysterious. I could certainly make it sound more exciting. But, yeah, just a nice little ski trip. But we did get 2.5 feet of snow the second night we were there. We had to,
welcome to winter.
I know. I got
welcome
a little
taste
to
winter. That's good. And now you got a taste of what poor Robert Dunn and everybody up north have been putting up with all these months.
Yeah, I feel bad for you guys because, I mean, the whole digging out the car process, I took photos. I should post them on Facebook because it was just amazing. Trying to dig out your car to get back and, like, one place we passed, it was like, you're not allowed to pass here or go any further without chains, snow chains. Like, we don't have any stupid snow chains.
No, I doubt
that
people
Phoenix.
From Phoenix have... We're expecting, actually, in the next couple of days, we have a flood watch because we're expecting Thursday and Friday 3 to 5 inches of rain over the 2 days.
No way.
It's going to be in the 40s and 3 to 5 inches of rain. So it's going to be a muddy mess around Kentucky over the next couple of days. But let's do our daily Winnie today. This one goes out to Elizabeth Tewksbury, who posted on our Facebook page, thank you for interviewing Jessica yesterday about the standardbred breed. My horse and I were one of the 8 standardbreds at the WEG this past October, and Jessica talked about that. They are a wonderful breed. Well, I know you didn't get a chance to listen to yesterday's show, but Jennifer was in heaven talking about standardbreds yesterday. I've never heard her so excited about a guest. She was having a great time with that, and we appreciate Elizabeth. Well, it's the first time I think you've posted on our page that I remember, so welcome to the show. Welcome to the Horses in the Morning, and we hope that you join us every day, not just when we're talking about standardbreds. Well, you're back, and then you couldn't help it. You get back. By the way, you came back a day early, which makes you a horse person. You get back a day early, and you decide to go horse shopping and torture yourself again.
Oh, my gosh, Glenn. You know, it's I have a student that is 11 years old, and she is looking for her move-up pony. She's got a nice little dead broke, you know, super awesome, worth, you know, his weight in gold paint horse. But she does some shows, and she wants to start jumping, and he's just not gonna do that job. So they're going to pass him on to her younger sister, so we're getting her a new pony. So we went and looked at ponies. We've been looking intermittently, but they have turned up the heat. They really are ready. I mean, they are ready to get a pony. So I had to drive an hour and a half one way yesterday to go look at this Morgan. And, you know, my previous experience, the last one I told you about horse shopping, is that the person lied about everything. Every single
right.
thing, the height, the weight, the training, the color, the age. I mean, they lied about everything. Well, this woman, it was definitely a breath of fresh air because she was so honest. She was so honest, in fact, that I almost didn't believe her until I got there and saw this horse. It was a Morgan pony who was super well-trained. She said, oh, it's just best kid's horse. She's actually done some, like, national finals in the Morgan horse showing world. This horse is trained. Perfectly trained. But we haven't really been doing much with it in the last couple years. So, you know, it's kind of, it's overweight and it's very fuzzy. And I said, okay, well, I mean, if it's so super trained, you know, they're like, yeah, kids been riding it about once a week. I said, okay, great, you know, that's. It was actually priced like it was currently in the show ring. So it was out of our price range, but we decided to go look at it anyway. And we get there. And can you post the picture of Facebook right now of this pony that I went and saw yesterday? Because
yes, I just posted it.
Yeah. If you look at... Such a great picture. If you look at the Facebook page on Horses in the Morning, this is the pony I went to sell. No, I am not kidding you, Glenn. This pony was not overweight. This horse was obese. I'm talking 400 pounds overweight. I went to feel the ribs on this horse, and I could not make it. Like, I couldn't. I was pushing as hard as I could on the side of this horse, and I couldn't feel the ribs at all. I was like, what are you feeding this pony? Mind you, 14 hands. Okay, 14-hand Morgan pony. Well, it only gets, you know, a couple flakes of alfalfa and a couple flakes of grass, and it gets grain, but not much because, you know, it just really feels. And I was like, this horse does not need alfalfa ever. She says to me, it's better to have them fat than skinny. And I said,
well, that's,
now where?
I guess that's true.
No, it's not. Where in the animal kingdom is it better to be fat than skinny? Where? Tell me what animal.
Wait a minute. I'm sort of relating, so that's why I'm agreeing.
Oh, my God. This horse is so fat. It was like we trotted it around the arena. I get on it because it was super trained. I mean, light as a feather, super calm, not a thing about it. I trotted it around the arena one time, and it was like... It was exhausted after one time around the arena. So, people... Fat is not better than skinny. Glenn, it is not better for people. It is not better for horses. I told this woman, I'm like, you are 30 days away from laminitis. You're 30 days away from founder. If it hasn't happened already, the horse looked totally sound. But my gosh, this was the fattest horse I've ever seen. I actually walked up to her because I couldn't help it. And I said, is this gelding pregnant? I'm sorry.
We have bought one like that, too. I had one driving pony that I bought that came in overweight, and she stayed, no matter what we did, she stayed muzzled, didn't matter. She stayed overweight the old time. So we just called her big-boned, and we were done with it. And even if I drove her a lot, she just was overweight. She was just a fatty fatso. But, you know, but Morgans don't usually, they're not usually that fat. I mean, they don't.
When I left, I said, I'm going to give you a super nice girl. I mean, super nice. And she was very understanding.
Well, at least she was honest.
Yeah, exactly. And I thanked her profusely for being so honest, because she said he was fat and she said he was hairy. And I thanked her profusely for the honesty. And I said, you know, the reason it didn't really work out was it didn't have the jumping experience that we were hoping. And she had told me that too. You know, he's I'm not selling him as a jumper. He's just kind of, you know, a great lesson horse, that kind of thing. But I said to her, I said, when I was leaving, I said, here, I'm gonna give you, do you a favor. You have got to starve this animal. You have to starve this horse. You've got to get 300 pounds off. She goes, but I feel bad for him. I'm like, you're going to kill him with kindness is what you're going to do. So stop feeding this horse alfalfa. There's no reason this horse needs amazing alfalfa from the West Coast. So stop it. Stop it. So that was my yesterday. Today we were supposed to go look at one, but it's sold already. So we are back to the drawing board as far as finding a pony for this child. So any suggestions, you're more than welcome to email me.
Wait, Jamie got back yesterday and went to look at this horse, and then yesterday afternoon we actually recorded next Monday's show. We're going to have a recorded show next Monday, and it's our monthly look at a equestrian musician, our monthly musician show, and we have a really cool guy that we're bringing to you next Monday, and we're not going to tell you what happened, but in 950 episodes on the Horse Radio Network, we had a first in recording this show yesterday, and you'll be able to hear what that was next Monday that had us just rolling on the floor. It was definitely a first. It has never happened in any of our shows before. So next Monday, stay tuned. We're not going to give it away, but you're going to definitely hear it. It'll be entertaining for you to hear, and you'll know exactly what we're talking about.
Oh, my God. It was so funny. I got to tell you, Glenn, though, in 83 episodes of Horses in the Morning, this is our 83rd episode, I've only cried in like 25 of them, and this was definitely one of those 25.
Oh my God, you're a blubbering idiot. By the time we were done, you were both crying. I was sitting there going, geez, now what am I going to do? They're both crying. The guest is crying, you're crying. I'm going, okay, I got to save this somehow. But it
oh
was
my
a
God.
Very,
I'm sorry.
It was very emotional at the end. It was
listening to a big tough cowboy cry talking about it. Oh my God, please, you guys, don't miss Monday. It's really, I thought he was amazing.
Cry.
Ah!
You go any further, you're going to cry again. So, and we got our guest on the phone. I don't want you crying before we talk to our guest. So let's get our collegiate of the month on here. Let's get our collegiate of the month on. I actually met Karen at the Young Riders here in the Young Rider Championships here in Kentucky over the summer. And, I selected her actually this month because I just thought, well, one, I knew she was a girl after your own heart, Jamie and Jennifer, because she's an eventer. And she goes to Texas A&M, and she majors in something that I have no idea what it is, and we're going to find that out here shortly. I want to welcome and congratulate Karen Shull for being our Collegiate of the Month from Texas A&M
Yay!
University. Hi, Karen.
Good morning, guys. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm glad you're here, too. You know, we've been following each other on Facebook, and I've been looking at your pictures of all your events and all that kind of stuff. Tell us, first of all, you're a senior this year, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay. You're soon done. Isn't that cool?
I know. It's like the light at the end of the tunnel. I can't wait.
Well, you're getting a degree in molecular and experimental nutrition. What the heck is that?
I have so many people ask me that. It is basically the study of not only what you eat, but what it does to you and the biochemistry and all the balance in your body. So it's not your dietitian type thing. It's more of like the people that want to be med students and go to medical school, this is what we do.
Okay, is that what you want to do? Do you want to go to medical school?
That's down the road. I'm about to take my MCAT in May. So
are you?
See how that goes.
Mm-hmm. Wow, cool. So you want to be a people doctor, not a vet?
Yes. I have two vets for parents, and I know I do not want to be one of those.
Okay. Why'd you decide to go to people?
It's always been really interesting to me. I have been a science major since I started college. I started as biology, didn't like that, went to nutrition. And it's much more interesting to me. It's challenging. I think I would be a good doctor to start with. So that's what I'm doing.
Cool. So no professional writing career for you? You a big eventer down there in Texas?
Yeah, you know, I thought about it for a couple of years, and I am taking some time off after I graduate in May to just focus on riding and work with my horses for a year or two and just see how far they can go, because I do have one that is coming back from an injury, but he's already at the three-star level, and I'd like to see how far he can go. And then I have another one that I'm looking to move up to advanced in the near future, but, I mean, I am taking the time off to focus on them because I think it would be an incredible waste if I didn't, but I've been around the professional sport enough to know that it's just not for me. I'd rather it be a hobby.
Well, that's good. And it's good you realize that, too.
Yeah, and being an advanced level eventer is just one of the I worked for three or four of them, and it's just, I mean, while it's an awesome life, it's a very tough life, and you have to kind of detach yourself sometimes emotionally from your animals when they do have those injuries and they do have that problem, and that's just very difficult, especially when you're like me and probably like you, when you love your babies more than anything in the world. So,
exactly.
Yeah. It's kind of tough, and I admire you pushing through with what you're with the horses that you have, and you know, finishing school. That's awesome. Congrats.
Thank you very much.
Well, Karen, you something that I noticed too from you guys last year when you're here in Kentucky for the young riders is I think that one thing you've gotten out of horses, and I think that you've gotten out of college too, but especially with the horses, is you guys were such a team and developed such a friendship. Working together in the Young Riders, that probably has been huge for you.
Yes. Young Riders this year, I guess last year, was completely different than the first time I went because I actually had a team, which was new, but they were all, you know, at least 5 years younger than me. But my little teammate, Jacob Fletcher, I guess he's 16 now, like, we have more fun than anyone, and you know, we go out to visit them. Like, I'm really close to his family now after being on a team with him. And we really do. Like, the bonds and the friendships I've gotten from horses are just incredible. Like, I know people all over the country. Whenever I'm traveling, I have someone to stay with almost in every state. It's amazing.
Wow.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that Young Riders does. And I think it's a terrific program. It's one of the things that Young Riders does. And you're going to have those connections now forever when you travel around doing events wherever you go.
Definitely, definitely.
How many events are there in Texas? Are they hard to come by?
We're improving. About 3 or 4 years ago, we were down to maybe 4 events. And people are usually surprised by that because they're like, oh, Texas, surely you have horses all over the place. You got to have events. And we just really don't.
You're right.
And,
it's Western. It's the Western.
Exactly. It's a lot of rodeos and it's a lot of, like, just cowboys out riding their horses. So we are getting more events. We probably have about 6 now in the state, but there's only one of them that goes up to intermediate, and then there's another intermediate in Louisiana, which is in our area still. But we are a little limited if you're looking to do upper-level competitions. So usually we travel and go out to Florida and do that kind of thing.
Well, you're definitely not from Texas because I don't hear that accent.
I was not born here, but I got here pretty soon, so I think I am.
By the way, happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
You just had a birthday 2 days ago, right?
It was Monday, and of course I had a test yesterday, so I didn't get to celebrate. So it will be this weekend.
Yeah, but you went to California over the weekend. I happen to know that.
Yes, I do. I mean, evidently you follow my Facebook, so.
Yes, I do. And I saw you went to California. It looked like fun.
Yes, I have a boyfriend that graduated in December, and he now has a job in Southern California. So I went to visit him, and it was a great birthday.
Now we know where her and the horses are going in May. Now we have an inkling of where they're going.
Well, that would be very expensive.
Well, congratulations again, Karen. Good luck with, do you have any job prospects, or is that something you're starting to think about here?
I'm currently trying to get certified as a phlebotomist, which is the person we all hate in the hospital.
A who?
They come and draw your blood.
Okay, got it.
Take your blood samples, so that'll be what I'm going to do for a year or two just to make my resume different than everyone else's.
She's going to stick people.
Yeah,
I love it.
She's kind of enjoying that, actually.
That and riding horses. It sounds like a good life.
Well, thank
no,
you,
Glenn.
Karen. Congratulations. What's that, Jamie?
Phlebotomy is not the study of bugs, okay?
No.
Just so you know. It's blood.
Thank you, Karen. You have a good day and good luck.
Thank you very much.
All right, that was Karen Schull of Texas A&M University, class of 2011, and our first ever molecular and experimental nutrition major.
Yeah, I don't even know what all that is, but she seems to know, and you know, I'm just glad we have people like her out there.
Yeah, that's right. And she wants to be a doctor. That's a noble. That's a noble profession, and she got a lot more school to go.
Exactly. Exactly.
She's a cute horse too. Post a picture of it. She has a cute horse that we'll post a picture of on our show notes today.
Oh, cool. Hey, I got to let you know, speaking of eventers, there's some big news, actually, Glenn, as far as eventing goes. If you've been to Rolex, I don't know, in the past 10 years, you've seen Philip Dutton, right, ride
yep,
a horse
yep.
named Connaught. Yeah,
sure.
And Connaught, Philip Dutton's 1993 Irish sport horse, basically he's remembered as the king of Rolex because this is his MO. He placed fourth in 2006, second in 2007. He won Rolex in 2008, was seventh in 2009. That's four straight years of top 10 Rolex performances, including a win. And he is now retired from advanced eventing. So this will be the first time in years that we will not see Connaught, Philip Dutton's horse, at Rolex.
Wow. So Connaught's finally hanging it up. I assume he'll be doing lower level stuff with probably some of his students and stuff, or is he completely retired?
Well, no, they're actually going to, let's see, he's going to give, and his barn name is Simon, I didn't know that, that's actually pretty cool, but I guess Philip's daughter-in-law or something, a stepdaughter is going to start eventing him. So can you imagine if, like, your stepdad is Philip Dutton, and you're like, oh, yeah, sure, you can have Connaught. Oh, my gosh, that'd be the coolest thing ever. You want to learn how to event, honey?
Doesn't it, Jamie?
Oh, my gosh. It sure does. Here, honey, if you want to learn to event, let me give you Connaught. Okay. Or to one Rolex. But we wish them the best, obviously. And he says that, I truly believe Simon Connaught loves to compete. I think this really shows in his exuberant jump, especially on cross country. I will never forget that feeling, and I'm now looking forward to watching Simon with Lily, his daughter-in-law, or stepdaughter. So, very cool. Good luck to them. And if I see them at a competition and they're in the lower levels and they're competing against me, I'm quitting.
You know, we've had that too, when Jennifer's competed and been against some mighty tough horses that have competed at upper levels and then have younger riders on them. But I was just cracking up over here while you were talking because Alan Moorhead, the host of the Western Radio Show, is doing a throwdown here on Facebook page.
He's ridiculous, and I wrote that.
Well, let's talk about our sponsor this half hour.
Our That's sponsor for this half hour. I'm looking for it. I'm sorry. I was trying to post something nasty to Alan. Okay. Well, Back on Track is our sponsor for today, and their products are endorsed by many of the top dressage, eventing, show jumpers worldwide. I'm sure that Philip Dutton and Connaught have also used some of their products. But they're not just for the pros, because any level of rider can benefit from their unique line of therapeutic products for horses, humans, and dogs. They also have some new products available, exercise boots, bell boots, even Western saddle pads. So Back on Track's product's genuine aim is to contribute towards your horse's well-being and good health in the easiest, most comfortable, and pleasant way. Learn more about Back on Track products at backontrackproducts.com.
And I wanted to highlight their product of the week is the Back on Track Mesh Sheet. It's one of their best sellers. It's a therapeutic sheet that is a breathable mesh material with state-of-the-art fabric containing polyester thread embedded with fine ceramic powder. It's designed to reflect the horse's own body warmth and creates a soothing infrared thermal heat, which can help alleviate pain and inflamed muscles and joints. It's used for both injury prevention as well as injury recovery. And that's the Back on Track mesh sheet at backontrackproducts.com. Well, we have back with us today, continuing a two-part series that we started last Wednesday show. If you didn't hear it, go back. It was the 16th. Look for the show on the 16th. And it's a two-part series because we just plain ran out of time talking to her. We were having so much fun. We had Kimberly Brown on, who talked about her hike of and climb of Mount Kilimanjaro, and that was so fascinating. And then the second part of her trip to Africa and Tanzania was a safari where she got to meet some animals that were slightly more wild than some of the ones Jamie's looked at recently in her horse searching. And she got to meet him up close and personal, and that, of course, is Kimberly Brown. Welcome back, Kimberly.
Thank you, thank you. It's always good to be on the show. And this time I promise that the Tourism Bureau in Africa is going to be very pleased with my account of the adventure.
Yeah, because they're about ready to wish you were never coming back after that talk about Mount Kilimanjaro and you throwing up every day and all that stuff.
I do recommend climbing Mount Kilimanjaro, but it is not for the faint of heart, for sure. But there's no training necessary to go on safari.
That's true, yeah.
Thank God.
So did you do safari before or after Kilimanjaro?
I did safari after the Kilimanjaro, and that was definitely the way to go because after climbing the mountain for 8 days, my legs were like jello, and I was really, really thankful just to sit down in the rover and go on hunt with our cameras for the big animals in Africa. And it completely exceeded my expectations because I thought that we were just going to be sitting and riding in the rover the whole time, and then every now and then we'd go, hey, get your binoculars and let's see from afar that little spot over there, that's a lion, and see that head bobbing, that's a giraffe. But actually, it was really engaging, and there were times when I was looking to the left and there was an animal behind me, and then somebody from our group, there were four of us, would say, oh, look in front, and oh, look behind. So it was really a lot more intense than I thought. And fortunately, instead of having to hike all of those miles through the area where we did the safari adventure, we got with the rover and the guide to take us. So that was super relief from the 8 days on Kilimanjaro.
I know you have some stories about some of the animals, and we're going to post some pictures in our show notes page as well. But Jennifer and I were talking after you were on the show last week, and we kind of ended the show, and we had a question. Once you climbed the mountain, how'd you get back down?
You know, sadly, there's some helicopter that picks you up at the top. You know, I think that's why people go helicopter skiing. You know, you don't have to climb to the top. They just fly to the top and drop you off, and you ski down. Well, in this scenario, we had to climb all the way up, and then we had to climb down. And we climb up the long way so that our bodies can acclimate to the high altitude, and then we go down the direct steep route. So we climbed up about 45 miles and straight down about 15 miles.
Oh, well, you know, you get to the top and then you have to think about getting back. I mean,
that's very true. And that's actually, you know, a lot of people that, you know, talk about Mount Everest because that's probably the most documented mountain climb out there as far as, you know, publicly accessible television shows. They talk about you get to the top and then you're only halfway. So part of what really psychs people out is, and climbing and getting to the summit of a big mountain, not just Kilimanjaro, but Everest and K2 and all the other big mountains, is that you've got to be able to have that mental capacity to say, I've got to make it to the top, and that's only halfway because I have to be healthy and sound and safe to make it all the way down. So the going down part, I would say, is probably harder on the body than going up, but going up is definitely more dangerous as far as being at risk for altitude sickness and not sure if you're going to make it because it's definitely a mental challenge for sure. And going down, it's, well, you know, what goes up must come down. I'm getting down one way or another, but it's going to be a little hard on the knees and hard to train for going down the mountain for sure. But that's a good question.
Well, and I just blew your commitment to the country of Tanzania, its tourist bureau, because we just pretty much talked out of it again. So.
Well, it's all about being prepared and all about choosing a great expedition company, which we did, because the whole way I felt very confident that, you know, even if I had a little bit of altitude sickness, I could look to our head guide and say, am I okay to keep climbing or not? And they made it very clear that if the guide said you have to turn around now, even if your mind says I want to keep coming, if the guy, you know, going up the mountain, if the guide says you have to turn around, that's it, game over. So on day two, I woke up thinking, oh, gosh, I hope he doesn't tell me I have to turn around. This is going to suck. But I was still, you know, within that healthy zone, even though I was uncomfortable. And so I was allowed to keep climbing, and I was able to make it physically and mentally, and it was very successful. And that's why we relied on really experienced guides, kind of like we rely on really experienced horse trainers. So,
well, now, so now we're on the safari. You had told us some stories when we got together a couple weeks ago about the safari. So share those. What were the highlights, and how up close and personal did you get with animals that wanted to eat you?
I got so close that it made my heart beat pretty fast, I would say. And one of the big surprises is that we also got to see the Maasai warrior village. And if you're familiar with any of the National Geographic or specials on Africa, the great warriors of that continent, the Maasai warriors have spanned over several countries and Africa, and they're the blood-drinking, lion-killing tribe in Africa. And when our guide told us that our first day of safari, I know, we were going to go to a Maasai village, asked if we wanted to go, and I said, absolutely, this is fantastic. I love experiencing culture. We got there, and then the guide said, okay, go on in. And so the four of us, it was my husband and I and our two friends here from Lexington, we went into the Maasai village. We were greeted by the chief's son, and he was very friendly, spoke a little bit of English, and my first thought was, gosh, I thought he'd be taller, because the Maasai warriors, we think of them as being, you know, 6.5, 7 feet tall, but he wasn't that tall. But the village had the big circular spears that were carved on the top with big points to keep out the wild animals, because they really were in the middle of the safari region where, you know, giraffes were wandering by and lions were stalking the village. We couldn't see them, but they were out there. And we got in the village, and they put these headdresses on us and did this welcome dance. And at that point, I thought, gosh, I know these guys drink blood. Are they cannibals? I sure hope not. I hope I'm not like in that Pirates of the Caribbean movie where he's welcomed like a king and then they want to eat him. So it wasn't like that at all.
I got to tell you, the Maasai tribe, I'm trying to remember the name of the show on National Geographic. It's Ollie and there's another guy. And they go to live with the Maasai tribe. And I almost wonder if that kind of helped you out a little bit, because now they're kind of more familiar with, you know, white people. It's an amazing show. And they basically lived with the Maasai tribe, and they had to become and do the things that the Maasai did, including, you know, drinking blood and eating monkeys or whatever they were eating, I can't even remember. So when you went there, and again, the Maasai are very dangerous people, were you nervous at all?
I was a little nervous when the guide did not go in with us. And at that
yeah,
point,
that would be a clue.
Yeah,
they're going along.
I'm like, I was thinking, Ayubu, what's going on? He's staying behind, because they did this welcome dance, put the headdress on us, and took us in, and we were surrounded, and they have about 100 people that lived in the village that we were in, and I didn't know what I was supposed to do, because they separated us apart. They said, we need to separate each other now. I'm like, separate? This is not good. But my friend Faye and I went in one direction, and our husbands went in the other, and our husbands did the jumping competition where they stand with the spears and they see how high they can jump. And then we went to the other side with the women where they did this dance and chant, and we were supposed to bounce around a little bit, and I wasn't exactly sure what we were saluting or dancing to, but it was great fun. And then we did go into one of their huts, which was a dung hut made of cow dung. And that's where they live. It's about a 10-foot diameter structure with a little fire pit in the middle. And they really live like that. So I have a great appreciation of the more primitive cultural lifestyle, because the 100 people in that tribe, with the exception of the chief and family, lived in that village area. And the chief lived up on the hill, and we couldn't see his hut, but I'm sure it was probably substantially bigger.
Remember right, the Maasai women are the ones that wear those collars too, the white, the
they
big collars. Yeah.
Yes, they put the collar on me, and I didn't know what the collar signified. I wasn't sure what I was supposed to do with it, but the beadwork was beautiful. And it's a little bit like visiting maybe an Amish community here in the United States where they preserve their culture, but now they recognize that they do need to be open to some of the outside, you know, more westernized civilization so that they can share their culture and vice versa. And so the Maasai warriors, their children do go to school in the mainstream school system, but they still live in their modern ways. And so when you're out in town in different parts of Tanzania, in, you know, Arusha was the major city, we could see some of the people dressed in the traditional bright red or bright purple wrap of the Maasai. And so that's how they're identified. They'll be out in the mainstream culture working other jobs, perhaps, but they still stay very true to their cultural dress, which is very beautiful
okay.
and striking and intimidating a little bit.
Now, is the are the Maasai the guys that wear the gourds?
No, they had the full, it's almost like a giant bath wrap that's a beautiful red tapestry, but it resembled mostly the fabrics that I would see probably in Scotland. A lot of
okay.
plaid, and I was very surprised, and I thought the plaid came from Scotland, so now I'm not sure, but the Maasai wore purple plaid and red plaid, and that was their traditional dress that they've worn for many, many, many years, and it's a giant wrap that goes down to about mid-shin.
I had
yeah,
to ask.
Okay,
so
it,
I just had to ask.
All right,
okay.
So,
yeah,
so I have
enough,
to get a spec. I have to get us back to animals now because
yes,
we're a
yes.
horse show. So tell us
absolutely.
About, so continue your adventure.
So people, culture, and animals, absolutely. So that was our first meet and greet on the safari was actually meeting the Maasai warriors. And then from there, we went to the Ngorongoro Crater, and that's actually where the Maasai lived in that area. And they're the only people that lived in that wildlife conservation area. No fences or designated areas where they say the animals have to stay. The animals just go because the crater is lush with wildlife. It's lush with food and water and everything else. So the most surprising thing that I saw there was that all of the animals were really fat. And it was comforting for me to see that because I knew we were coming at the very end of a dry season, and I thought, oh, gosh, we're going to see these really emaciated animals, and, oh, it might be sad. I was trying to prep myself for that. But all the animals were fat, and we saw, first of all, in the Ngorongoro Crater, cheetahs, a pair of cheetahs, and apparently that's extremely rare. It was about 10 after 6 in the morning. We were the first safari vehicle in that conservation area because our guide was super aggressive about making sure we were number one to see what was happening at sunrise. And I have a big picture of a cheetah taking a giant yawn in the morning, and then they were playing around a little bit. And I thought, oh, great, I've seen the big cats. This is it. And then we went on a little bit, and we saw zebras, which I just was completely astounded by. There were hundreds and hundreds of zebra everywhere we looked, but they were a little skittish, so it was hard to take a photo of a zebra. And they were tiny. I'm surprised by how tiny the zebras were. And then still pretty early in the morning, and our guide, our driver, gets on the radio, and he's speaking in Swahili. And I hear a bunch of Swahili, and I hear Simba, Swahili, 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 Simba, which is the Swahili word for lion. And I went, oh, that's
lion.
A lion. Yay, this is exciting. And I said, what's happening? And he goes, we have a lion sighting. It's a morning kill. And I made a rule that I didn't want to see any animals taken down. That just wasn't going to happen because as an animal lover, I can't take that. But there was an animal already that had been hunted down, and there was a lion sighting. And there was another vehicle behind us, and our safari guide said, hold on. And I'm standing up looking out of the top of the sunroof area. And he takes off down the path like a car chase in a movie, and he runs this other safari vehicle just about off the road because we're jockeying for position to see who's going to be first on the trail. And we get there first, and we arrive to see the biggest, fattest lion I've ever seen in pictures or even imagined about 100 yards away. And he had the big pot belly, and he was standing there still, looking left and looking right, and just looking around and licking his lips and taking a big yawn. And then on the other side of us, this is where we look left, look right, there was a pack of hyena, and the hyena were watching us, watching the lion, because when the lion is done feeding, then the hyena gets to move in, and then after the hyenas are done, then the jackals move in. And so it was really amazing to watch that circle of life come through and the hierarchy and the food chain on how everybody survived with that one giant kill. And it was in the little bit of the marshland, and we couldn't tell what it was. And, of course, my curiosity got to me. I said, I know I didn't want to see any dead animals, but I've got to know what the takedown was for today. What was the prize this morning? And actually, about that time, a ranger vehicle showed up, and the rangers jump out with these big rifles. And I thought, oh, my gosh, they're going to be eaten by a lion right in front of us. What are they doing? And it turns out that the ranger station had been monitoring what was happening in that area, and they thought that the lion had killed a black rhino, which is a very endangered species. I think a few years ago there were only 10 or 15 left in the world, and they were in that area. Well, it turns out it was not a black rhino. The lion, actually the lionesses, had killed a Cape buffalo, which is an enormous beast, and that's why there was so much feeding activity and so many different animals that were really getting a fill, and everybody was walking out with a full belly. So it was an endangered animal. It was one of the very plentiful but sad day for the water buffalo. And that's how we started off our safari that morning, and I thought, oh, my gosh, it just can't get better from here. And then we had our breakfast at the hippopotamus pool. And at the hippopotamus pool, we've been conditioned so much that you don't get out when you see hippos. You just watch them from afar because they're very territorial. And, of course, the guide says more people get injured or killed by hippopotamus than anything else. They just bite you in half and spit you out, but they won't eat you. I'm like, well, that doesn't help.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's comforting.
Oh, okay.
So we had a very, very good respect for the animals because Faye, at one point, she's in trouble now, jumped out of the rover vehicle to take a picture of a giraffe, and a ranger had driven by and, you know, was shaking his hand and yelling at her. And thought, oh, Faye, you better get back in the car right now. And she goes, well, I won't do that again. So they're really serious about keeping the visitors safe. But we get out at the hippo pond. Our Yubu, our guide, says, okay, we get out now, and when we have breakfast. I said, well, I'm not getting out. You get out.
So, you're the one that sent us into the man-eating village over there.
Exactly. I'm like, wait a minute. I think I've learned my lesson. I'm going to stay in the Range River right now, and I'm just going to eat my breakfast in my lap. And he's like, no. It's safe. The hippos, and there were probably 20 of them, they're sleepy, and the water is cold, and all they'll do is just make a lot of noise, and you just move very slowly and whisper. I said, okay, well, this is fun. So I get out, and we actually get some pictures, and then a Yubu starts talking to the hippos and making some grunting, squawking noises, and they start talking back. And it was the most amazing thing I have ever seen in my life. And we're looking at the hippos, and then, of course, our guide, who's very keen with his eyes and surroundings, says, oh, well, there's a hyena behind us stalking us, but pay no attention to the hyena. I'll watch him. You keep watching the hippos. We'll see more hyenas later. And I went, oh, my gosh, I'm getting back in the car. Well, he brings out our little box breakfast, and we pull out our breakfast on the hood of the car, and we're eating breakfast. And our friend Jason is getting ready to take a bite of this wonderful banana muffin bread, and he goes to take a bite, and a bird swoops down, pulls it out of his hand, and flies off. But this is like fantastic. Park out here. This is crazy. But it was amazing. And, you know, I knew I was safe as long as I did what the guide said, but it was really special to be out there with all the animals and know that if we're looking in one direction, we could have a hyena behind us. And then later, while we were having breakfast, we could see the one elephant that was walking over to the water to drink. And I thought, gosh, this is just breakfast, and I feel like I've already had the experience of a lifetime. And so from there, we drive on, and we saw during that day, we actually were on safari 2 days, probably about an hour and a half of actually seeing animals. And that's more than most people see when they go on a two-week safari. We saw.
That was a lot of animals.
20 or 30 different animals. And we saw warthogs. We saw baboons up close. We saw zebra everywhere. We actually got in line behind the zebra to the watering hole because they formed this single file line, kind of like horses coming back to the barn when they know it's dinner time. And the zebra had followed the single file line, and they were headed off to the water. And we were trying to go that same way, and our driver said, well, I guess we'll just get in line with the zebras. So we got in line, and then the zebras continued their line behind us. And so we were going about 3 miles an hour down this little path as one of the zebras, and it was very cool, and they didn't mind us at all at that point. But if we tried to drive up and get close to them at other places, they would just politely turn and walk away. But I did get some good pictures,
yeah.
So that was great. But the the height of what I really wanted to see was the big lions, and I thought I'd had my fill from that first sighting in the morning. Well, it was hot in the afternoon, and again, I hear a lot of chatter on the radio. We don't see any cars anywhere else, any rovers, until there's some really cool sighting, and then a few of them will come out of the woodwork, and I don't know where they come from. They just appear. Well, Ayubu's on the radio, and I hear Simba, Simba again, and I thought, oh, this is going to be great. Well, he speeds off, and he says, hang on, and we're driving down, kicking up dust everywhere on the path, and we drive up, and there are a ton of safari vehicles that have just appeared out of nowhere, and it turns out that one safari vehicle had driven up and seen a couple of big lions wandering around way out in the middle where there are no trees, and the lions have gotten really smart. The lions see the rover. Well, the rover casts a big shadow. And so what the lion had done, he'd walked over to the safari rover and laid down in the shadow. So
at your rover? Like at your feet?
Yes. When we drew him up, he was laying down at another rover's shadow, and our driver got all the way up there. And I've got this great video that I need to post online where I'm going, oh, my goodness, there's a lion right there. Because as soon as the rover pulled away, there was a lion laying right in the shade. And what had happened is he got really grumpy when his shade left. And so he got up and looked around in both directions and laid down in the next rover beside him because there were a few lined up. Well, we drove around, turned around, and came up the other way. And when we were right there in the other direction, the rovers that had been there for a while pulled away, and I'm filming the lion that I said, oh, gosh, he's leaving, and I'm filming him. And the rover in front of us pulled away, and there was a lion probably 10 feet from me, big, full mane around his neck, big male lion, full belly. And I was filming one lion, and he was 10 feet away from me, and his shade had moved, and his neck shade was right under our vehicle, and he looked me straight in the eye, and I thought, oh, this is a grumpy lion. This is not good. What's going to happen now? And so that's the point where I dropped my camera. I slammed the sliding window closed. I think I may have screamed, and then and I thought, what kind of adventurer am I? But the lion walked all the way up to our safari vehicle. And our guide said, oh, we can't get stuck with a lion under our car. So at that point, we'd been there about 30 minutes. And so we drove off, and he went to the next car to lay down. But literally, the breath of the lion and the smell of the lion was right in front of my face. And it was the most primal, visceral experience ever, because I didn't think he was going to eat me because he was pretty full. But I thought he might be really mad and just take a swipe. And he's going to get my camera and probably my arm, because I had my arm hanging out the window. And it was just smart lions. And that's what they do. They follow the shade of the safari vehicles. So that's how you get up close and personal with a lion. And that's the Ngorongoro crater is really key for being able to see that, because they've got the most large land mammals of any other area in the world, according to a couple of different sources, including our guide. And it really was true to form, because we were face-to-face with everything. And that lion, you know, I've got a picture of him laying underneath the rover, snuggled up against the tire, taking a nap. So we just sat there and watched the big lion sleep.
Wow. Oh, wow. That's incredible. Well, between Kilimanjaro and face-to-face with lions and having jackals stalking your lunch, I mean, you've just crossed something off of your bucket list for sure. This trip is just amazing, and we're so glad that you were able to share it with us. What did I'd be curious to know two things. The whole trip put together, can you tell us what it cost per person? Do you have any idea? If somebody wanted to do this?
Yes. To climb Mount Kilimanjaro can cost anywhere from about $2,000 to $8,000 per person, depending on the duration, if you choose a five-day hike or an eight-day hike, and the company that you choose to climb with. And then the safari was an add-on to our Mount Kilimanjaro adventure. So the safari was only probably about $2,000 more, I think. Because that included a couple of days of travel and then our trip. So it really was you know, we could have taken a trip to Hawaii and spent about the same amount of money as we did in Africa, because the food and accommodations are really affordable. The Mount Kilimanjaro climb is the most costly part of it, because that's where we had to have all of our provisions, have our, you know, life-saving guides and a lot of the expertise there. And
your
safari
equipment,
equipment. And safari was more expensive on a day-to-day basis than going to a regular resort, just because we did a lot of travel. We went to Lake Manyara the first day and then Ngorongoro Crater the second day, and then we flew out. So the whole trip you can probably do from anywhere from, depending on the amenities that you add, anywhere from, I would say, you know, $5,000 to $12,000.
And a year's worth of work.
I gotta ask, where are you going in Hawaii that cost $10,000? Because I want to go to that resort. My God.
Well, if I was there for a total of 3 weeks.
Yeah. I gotcha.
Right. So by the time you add it up, and actually from that perspective, you know, once you add up all the days and the nights and the flights and everything else, it works out where we could have gone somewhere domestically and lived really well for a 3 week vacation. You know, I know a lot of people go on a ski trip and they'll spend $10,000 to go on a ski trip by the time they get their lift tickets and they stay in the lodge and they do everything else. And this was definitely a bucket list for me, and I waited more than 20 years to be able to go and plan the trip more than a year in advance. So I got to do the safari, which was phenomenal, and the athletic adventure too. So it was well worth it, but it'll probably be about 5 years before I go anywhere else.
I was just going to say, I know you, Kim. There's something else now. You may have crossed that up to your bucket list, but I know you. There's something else on there. So what's the next one?
You know, I'm not exactly sure what my next adventure is going to be. I'm probably going to have to wait and recuperate for a few years. But my grandmother always said that if you reach for the stars, you'll never come up with a handful of mud. So I take that true to heart for my adventures as well.
Well, thank you, Kim. We appreciate you being on. By the way, everybody, that was $10,000 and a year's worth of preparation, getting in shape, and then being sick every day for 8 days. So that's pretty much what it was. But, Kim, we appreciate it. We're going to post you. I have a picture that I stole off your page of you and your guide in front of the hippo pond at lunch. And then we also have the picture of the lion that you got up close and personal with. And it's so funny because I said to Jamie, I said, either she had a really long lens or this lion was eyeing her up, because the picture is right up close. So
I used a regular pocket camera.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
Just a little cheapy pocket camera. So that lion was right there.
Yeah, sure was. Well, thank you, Kim. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure.
All right. Bye, Kim. Well, that was fun. She is a great storyteller. What a fantastic storyteller. What a fantastic story. I mean, she had a story to tell, so that's kind of neat.
Exactly.
Well, this half hour is sponsored by FeedXL. FeedXL will help you keep your horses fat just like those lions. They'll help them keep them healthy and not skinny, like Jamie said earlier, because you can go to FeedXL.com and find out if you're feeding your horses correctly, if they're getting all the nutrition, if they're getting all the vitamins, the supplements, and everything that they need. You just take a couple minutes, plug in information about your horse, plug in information about what you're feeding your horse or horses, and it will spit out reports that breaks down each part of each feed and each thing that you're giving your horse, and it'll tell you whether you're feeding too much or too little of any particular thing. If you want to know that you're doing it right, and if you want to have the peace of mind to know that your horse is being fed correctly, FeedXL.com is the place to do it. That's FeedXL.com. Today's song is dedicated to my friend Michelle, our friend actually, Jennifer and I's friend, Michelle Rick from Louisiana. And of course, we've had Michelle on several times, and we've been talking about her horse Sprite, who's now in recovery over the last, it seems like forever, Michelle, we've been talking about your horse Sprite. After two operations for colic, she is now wearing one of those big, silly-looking belly band things. What were they called, Jamie? What are they called?
I think they're called belly bands.
Oh, really? Okay, good. It's to keep the stitches and hernias and all of that from popping out. She looks kind of silly wearing it. Looks very embarrassed. But I found a song that by Trish Lynn that I thought was so appropriate for Michelle, because she married herself. Well, she married herself the guy that we're talking about in the song. It's called On the Bayou by Trish Lynn. And I hope that Michelle's listening today and listening to the words of this song, because it's your life, Michelle.
start a brand new life. Gather everything and throw it in a sack. Once you're down there, you won't want to come back. When the folks are grinning, even in the swamp land, always willing to give a helping hand. Catfish, crawfish, and young folks too. Always something cooking on the bayou. Singing out, hey, yo. Sure like to go down to Louisiana on the bayou. Picking at the fiddle on the Cajun song. Down in Louisiana where I belong. Down in Louisiana where I belong. Hey! He said a 10 bucks fool and a fine below. Just what that means, well, I'll never know.
Michelle Rick and Sprite that's on the bayou. And, you know, I got to just point this out. Before we get to our weekly horse health report, Glenn, we got some major trash talking going on our Facebook page because Alan Moorhead of the Western Radio Show thinks, because he's all jealous that we have more Facebook friends than he does, he thinks he's going to, you know, talk a little bit of trash to us. And he said, you know, that he, when you're sick one day or if you're not going to be on the show or you're taking a vacation that he's going to fill in for me, I told him I was going to call in sick that day.
Well, you better call in sick tomorrow. Don't you remember he's filling in for me tomorrow?
No, he is not. You're kidding. Okay.
I am kidding.
You scare me. I'm like, woo, I'm starting to feel real sick, Liz. Oh boy, I thought I missed that memo. Oh, anyway, so if you want to go talk a little trash, you know, and you are, if you're a fan of ours and you're a fan of the Western Radio Show, go click unlike on their page. There you go, Alan. Take that. So anyway, back to the actual show here. You know, so many of us are affected by a disease. I mean, probably, you know, the most common disease in horses, which is colic. And, of course, colic is, you know, I'll let them tell you, but it's abdominal pain. And we have a, you know, it's that time of year, Glenn, where the weather is changing. We get cold days. We get hot days. We get days where the horses want to drink a lot of water and days where the horses don't want to drink a lot of water. And so we've got thehorse.com to kind of sift through all of the colic information and let you know kind of what it is, how can we prevent it, what causes it, all of those things happen. And, of course, we have Dr. Jones with us this morning and, of course, Christy from thehorse.com. So, first of all, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I that this is such an amazingly important topic because I just don't know any horse people that have not been affected by colic. I know when I was, I mean, I have a chronic colicker now, unfortunately, that we're working on. But we also had a horse that when I was 21 years old required two colic surgeries back to back. And, you know, that's a good 12 grand back then. It was even more now, I'm sure. But, you know, we were just talking about Michelle and Rick and their horse Sprite, who's had a couple colic surgeries. So I think it's a great time to be talking about colic.
I think it's
absolutely.
It's always a good time, and thanks for the intro. I think that you brought up a lot of good points that we were obviously going to hit today, and we thought we'd start with just a basic discussion of what colic is and what to look for. What are some of the signs of colic that some you may be familiar with and some you may not? So, Erin, can you tell us a little bit about those?
Absolutely. Well, first off, my thunder was stolen as what is actually colic, so that's okay. I'm glad that we have informed host of the show. It is
that'd
be
Jamie,
abdominal
pain. By the way.
I was trying to do a cross the board compliment there, and you just had to ruin it, didn't you? it does mean abdominal pain, but there are some, and we were going to mention them at the end of the show, but I guess I'll take the moment now to mention them. There are some that aren't actually coming from the abdomen, meaning the gastrointestinal tract. They are coming from in the abdomen, like liver disease can look like colic. Peritonitis, which doesn't really affect the intestinal tract directly, it's the belly or that cavity that holds the intestines together, that can look like colic. But even pleural pneumonia, when a horse does a long shipping, gets a really bad respiratory infection and actually infects the pleura, they can look like colic because they stretch out. They want to get any pressure off their chest because it hurts. It's very painful.
Aww.
And then you can have kidney and urinary issues that may look like colic. And that's so rare. The liver, the kidney, urinary, those are more rare things. So we're not going to go into those much today, but I just want everybody to know that abdominal pain is the definition for it, but there are other problems. But let's go into the clinical signs of it. What the normal thing everybody says is they're rolling. The other thing, very subtle, looking at their sides. Of course, not eating, that's a big key because horses eat all the time. And then the one that really seems to get everybody a little confused is the stretching out. I get numerous phone calls that says, my horse is trying to urinate and can't urinate. Not a urinary tracting problem. They're stretching out their abdomen because, again, just like the pleural pneumonia in the chest, they want to make some room for whatever GI upset they're having, and they stretch out their abdomen, or they're just stretching it out and try to get to a comfortable position the way they're standing. And it looks like they're trying to urinate, especially gelding, and nothing is coming out, so they think it's a urinary tract infection. And, of course, they're depressed.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what else? I can always tell when, and maybe this is something that I'm making up, but when my horse colics, our old thoroughbred outside, he paws a couple times, lays down, gets up, and I always know he's colicking because he doesn't shake off. Like, you know, they roll and they roll around and then they get up and they shake. When he doesn't shake is when I start to worry about him.
Again, stealing my thunder, but I love it.
Sorry, I'll stop.
No, this is what I want.
She does that to me every day.
No, you're actually driving home. The main point of this topic today is that you need to know your animals. And just that minor difference you see, and that's minor to some other horse people, that minor difference tells you a lot about how your horse is feeling. And those subtle changes make a world of difference in how quickly you act on a sick horse or not. Kudos to you.
I'm going to stop talking now. Keep going.
No, that's
good stuff. So, do we want to shout out some causes of colic?
Let's do it.
Yes.
Go ahead. I'm going to let Jamie and Glenn shout out one each.
Wait, what now? I couldn't hear you. You broke up a little bit. Say that again.
Shout out the causes of colic. Give me one cause that, you know, one thing that causes colics that you know of.
Okay, here in Arizona, it's sand.
Wonderful. Here in Florida, it's sand. It's almost the number one here, so I'm sure it is in Arizona. Glenn, do you have one?
Yep.
Eating too much.
Yep.
I colic from eating too much. So I figured the horses probably do too.
I figured you'd say he colics when he thinks about our bloody shows.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, that's the stress. That's another one. So he's exhibiting stress, and he's concerned about what we're going to talk about, and so he gets stressed out about it. And stress can cause colic, and it comes in many forms. We talked about stress of a trailering trip, stress of going to new environments, stress of being put into a new herd and doing the pecking order, stress of increasing your exercise regimen or going off your exercise regimen. Some horses are just more prone to getting stressed out, and that stress will lead to a different kind of colic, not a sand colic, not a too much feed colic. It's more of a ulcer colic. So we have ulcers as another source.
And then what about, you know, I've had horses that have had gas colic before, but how do they get gas colic?
It's usually from a decrease in water is the theory. And that's another key point I want to drive home today is that horses always need clean, fresh water. If there's one thing a horse needs, it's not hay, it's not grass, and definitely not grain, it's water. Water is paramount for any living being, so they need to have fresh, clean water. Even if you provide it and you drop that big roll bale out there and they've been sitting on a sand lot, let's say in Arizona or here in Florida, had a little bit of hay given to them, or they eaten up the last little remnants of grass, you plop that big roll bale out there in the middle. Next thing you know, your horse doesn't come up for air. It's got its face buried in that roll bale. It doesn't come up for air, and you've got yourself colic because they didn't add the water to the mix. They need water to do the fermentation back in the hindgut, as they call it, to keep the GI tract moving accordingly. We also have some other ones. We have, I'm just going to go ahead and just shout them out myself. We have worms. We haven't seen that in years, but tapeworms kind of reared their ugly heads for a while. But we do have a dewormer now for tapes. But back in the late 70s, early 80s, our ivermectin that came out seemed to help out with most of the really bad worm colics we had.
I have a question about that. Okay, so this is a neighbor of mine, and you can't always control what your neighbors and friends do with their horses, but they have this horse that came into her boarding facility that was completely full of worms, apparently. That's what it had been, hadn't been wormed and dewormed in forever. And so she said, okay, I want you to hit it with the ivermectin, and again, you know, in a week, hit it with the astringent, then hit it with Panacure. And I thought, to me, if we have a horse that has a huge amount of worms, and all of a sudden you kill all those worms, and then they go through the small intestine, what is the chance of an impaction of worms?
Very high. Seen more in the babies, but it is high. The other thing is all the dead beings, dead bacteria, dead worms that live in the gut will release toxins when they die too. And that toxin release can cause excessive gas because the bacteria producing gas, excessive gas, you get your gas colic. You got toxins that give them basically a change in pH and cause a colic from that. Impacting is another thing that I'd be concerned about. I always tell people when they get a rescue horse, give a slow kill dewormer. Fenbendazole is a really nice one. It does a slow kill of worms over a period of time. But again, doing the fecal is key. See what kind of worms are in there, how many. Do your dewormer, come back, recheck that fecal, do another one according to what they see on the fecal exam, and that would be the more appropriate way to address a rescue or a horse that's overly wormy.
Thank you. I'm going to have her call you.
I'd love to talk to her. I don't have a problem. I got an 800 number they can call if they're worried about the long distance fees, but if they get their cell, they can call.
Yeah, and I just said you can't give a horse, first of all, that much dewormer all at once, and second of all, if you're going to kill a million worms, they're all going to come out at the same time, and that just seems very dangerous, as I thought anyway. So thank you for answering the question.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. So let's see, other causes. Well, we talked about too much feed, but we didn't talk about the abrupt change in feed, which happens a lot. Somebody gets a new horse, they decide they want to put them on their high percentage protein. You're working these horses heavily, but it came off of a pasture where it was doing nothing and it was giving a low percent protein, so that abrupt change in feed can cause the colic. Some of the
why is that?
Because the bacterial flora, they're used to a certain type of feed product coming through, and they're made for that feed product. And when you change their source of food, is if you want to put it that way, is the best way to describe it. They get confused. They get upset. That sometimes they have a party and they do overload of trying to digest for you and overload, dye, produce gas, that kind of thing. Or they may not digest them well enough because they're not the proper bacteria flora for that type of feed. So it's
so
a slow adjustment to them, to your
gotcha.
GI bacteria.
Gotcha. So when you get a new horse and they say, here's your horse, you always ask for some feed and some hay, and you mix it slowly. And I've always thought maybe that was just for the horse's palatability, I guess. You know, like, here, we're
no,
trying
No, it's for their
new
GI
horse.
System. It's for their bacteria. Let's give a good example. You go out of town, you're on a special occasion, anniversary, convention, anything you can think of, and you're going to have a really nice meal. So first off, you went out of town. That kind of stresses, that raises our stress levels because we're not in our own home. And then you go and have this wonderful, delicious, rich meal. Kind of get a little stomach upset sometimes after that rich meal because it's not your normal everyday meals you're having at home. It's cooked a little differently.
Gotcha.
That kind of thing. So you
and
upset
what
your
I would
GI flora.
Yeah, and what I would do is throw up, but clearly horses can't throw up. So there you go.
Exactly. That's where the whole problem comes in, is they can't throw up. So.
Exactly. Well, we talked a little bit about, Jamie, you mentioned weather changes, and that's another one that we want to bring up, is that it's and I were talking about this yesterday, is that it's not always the weather change necessarily, but as you mentioned, the weather change causing a change in water intake or feed
yes.
intake or exercise or things like that.
Yes, it kind of changes their normal regimen. They have tried numerous times to document that weather definitely causes colic, but it's not always that fact because they've had weather change in numerous research studies, and the horses did fine. So we think it's either due to a lack of water intake during that weather change time, or they're wearing their big, long, hairy coat. We get a nice, warm spring day. They tend to sweat profusely under that warm coat, and they're taking in the same amount of water they did the week before, but it was colder. And they're not losing so much water, and thus they can possibly have a real mild colic from that. Again, back to water, clean, fresh water.
Right.
Clean,
so that kind of makes
water.
Weather sort of a surrogate factor for colic, meaning you think it's weather, but it's actually something that's associated with the weather, but it's not the weather itself. And that kind of brings me to, we've got a nice stump the host question. Do you happen to know, Jamie or Glenn, what breed has been identified as being at greater risk of colic than other breeds?
What breed? Wow. That's a great question. I would probably say thoroughbred.
And I'm going to go with warmbloods.
That's
on both of them.
You both?
Aunt on both of them? Okay.
Yeah, I can't do that ant button. I don't know if you guys have one of those, but both of them did not win the prize. It's Arabians.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yes.
Is it because they're just uber-sensitive kind of horses?
They think because of the management of Arabians, a lot of them are show Arabians. Now, granted, this came off of a study where they sent out information gathering type tools to say, hey, you
surveys.
Know. Surveys. Thank you. That's important. for animals, what breed do you have? What do you do with that kind of thing, and they found more than not that the Arabs were at a higher risk, and they think or surmise that it's possibly due to their way they're housed or the way they're managed. They suggested maybe there's a genetic predisposition. Nobody has ever gone down that road to show it, so...
Well, that makes sense simply because a lot of the show horses and the show barns, you know, the horses are in for quite some time. And you know, it's been proven to show. And the reason I said thoroughbreds is because horses that are housed inside that work very hard and then go back to their stall, you know, they can get ulcers. And the stress of traveling and showing and racing and competing, that causes ulcers, which would then... you know, help out with colic. I must tell you, Dr. Jones, that my existence here at Flyover Farm is colic prevention. Everything that I do, I'm like, please don't colic, please don't colic, please don't colic. So, I mean, we do things like the, like if it's just a little bit chillier, and I want to run this by you because I know a lot of people do it, and I want your opinion on it, is when it's a little bit chillier, I think, okay, they're not going to drink as much water. So I'm going to give them some electrolytes to try to encourage them to drink water. And I also always put water in their grain. Are those two things that are good or just me being crazy?
Well, encouraging them to drink water is great, but the old phrase is you bring a horse to water but give them drink. It's very
yeah.
true. We've tried, you see it in the endurance trail riding people all the time, we've tried the electrolyte pastes to either just give to them orally and hope that encourages them to drink more water, kind of like the salty popcorn at a movie theater idea where you're going to get up and get another soda, or adding more electrolytes to the feed. As far as watering down their hay, as far as water putting water in their grain, they've never proven that that really does increase any water content in a horse.
Okay, well, I'm going to tell you what it does do is it makes mama feel better.
And that's important.
As long as you're helping somebody.
Treating the client. Well, you guys, we are almost out of time. Do you have any other one or two more items that you want to go over before we wrap this up?
Well, I wanted to mention that dental problems and mastication issues. Again, mm-hmm. we've had that discussion a few weeks ago that those could be problems for your horse to colic, so you definitely need to stay up on your dentals.
It's so great that you mentioned that because, of course, we have an Ask the Vet live session, hour-long session on dentistry on online chat tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock Eastern, 8 p.m. And if you want to sign up for that, you can do that right from the horse.com's homepage right now. Dr. Denny Jones will be one of the panelists.
The last but not least comment is you are your primary caregiver of your horse. The owner is a primary caregiver, not the veterinarian, not the farrier, sometimes not even the barn manager, but the barn manager does kind of act the surrogate for you. You know when your horse is different. So if you say, gosh, you know, this water intake thing, God, that's so great, but, you know, I got a tank out there. I fill it up every day. I got three horses that drink out of it. How do I know who's drinking, who's not? You're going to know there's less water in the tank one day, and you're going to have to watch all three, and you're going to know one's not acting quite right. And that's all you need to know that there might be a problem ensuing. And so knowing, again, that your horse rolls, gets up, and doesn't shake, and that's a sign of possibly a colic, it's worth just having a good physical exam on the horse in the next 24 hours to make sure everything's okay and maybe take some precautions of adding oil to the feed that night or whatever you need to do, increasing their water intake that night, whatever you need to do to kind of warn off that colic that you might think might come down the road.
Absolutely. Great advice. Just know your horse and, you know, trust your instincts.
Exactly.
But you guys did good. I was actually sitting here eating lunch during the show today.
Did you want me to get it, Glenn?
All this talk about colic and food made me hungry. So,
I was hoping that maybe you might have spaghetti today with all the worm talk we might have.
Now I don't want to eat lunch.
Oh, good job.
Thank you, guys. We appreciate you being on. And that's thehorse.com. If you want to sign up, you guys do some terrific seminars there. So that's tomorrow night, you said, which would be Thursday night, correct? The 24th.
Yes. Correct.
Okay.
8 p.m.
All right. Thank you, Christy. Thank you, Dr. Jones. You guys have a great day.
Thank you.
You too.
Bye-bye. Well, there we go. All that talk of colic, it really did make me hungry. I was sitting here thinking.
Glenn, you know what's funny is the last clinic that I worked at, I worked at the Durango Clinic here in Phoenix, and my second day on the job, we had to perform a necropsy, which is, you know, when you cut the horse open and you find out what's wrong with it. And I remember saying to them, I said, okay, so where do you guys send the necropsy? Where do you send the horse? And they were like, oh, no, we don't send it anywhere. We do it right here. I was like, what? So out comes this veterinarian and, like, unsheathes the sword to check the horse. I mean, it was like Luke Skywalker with the lightsaber, whoom, cut the middle of the horse open. All these women are standing around, my vets and technicians, and they, you know, they're figuring it was a horse that had colics, and they're figuring out why, and they found the twist. And the doctor that I worked for goes, hey, Jamie, could you grab one of those rectal sleeves right there? I was like, okay, sure. I grab it. He goes, put it on. I'm like, no. He's like, my second day on the job, okay? Put the sleeve on. So I put it on. He goes, here, feel this. And he takes my hand and plunges my hand inside this horse's belly. And he's like, you feel that? That's a twist. And I'm like, of course. Like, I got it. Okay, I feel it. Well, I get my hand out of there. And then at the end of this, you have to put the horse back together so it can then be picked up. And this is probably too much information for so many listeners, but I lived it and I was there and I was about to throw up the entire time. So we put the horse back together as I'm dumping stuff in the intestines into a bucket because it wouldn't fit in there. We sew this horse back up with baling twine and the people come to get it. And I'm not kidding you, Glenn. As God is my witness, four women go, man, I'm starving. Let's go have lunch. I'm like, what? I am so nauseous. From then they're like, dude, something about doing a necropsy makes me hungry. I'm like, ow! Gross! That's when I realized I was right not going to vet school. I will never be a veterinarian as so long as I live. That made them hungry. And I couldn't eat for like 3 days.
Oh, I'm dying here.
And that's a true story. I wish that my friend, the veterinarian I worked for right now, I know she's listening, Misa, would call in because she would back that story up. They were all starving. I had to go home. I was like, I can't stay here anymore.
I think Jamie, we should just end the show on that and leave everybody with the thought of you with one of those gloves up to your shoulder. I think we just need to leave them with that thought. Be sure to listen. I just want to say, oh my God. What makes this so funny for everybody that hasn't seen Jamie in person is she's 5'2¾". She's tiny. So, I mean, just her whole body had to be inside that horse. So anyway,
God, it was awful.
Tomorrow we have a terrific show planned. I need to talk about tomorrow because I am so very excited. Jennifer got a coup here. She has the guy who trains the Budweiser Clydesdale horses for the commercials. How cool is that? He's going to tell us how they trained them. For that commercial, you know, where the snow all falls down on him. Remember that one from a couple of years ago of the tree? The snow and the tree all falls down on him. Well, he actually he trained him for that commercial and some others. Isn't that cool? And then also, Reese is going to be back. She's down in Wellington. But she wrote to me yesterday and she said, don't you guys want me on this month to do my recipe? And I wrote back and said, well, you're in Wellington competing. We didn't think you brought a recipe along. She said she did. They even tested it down there to make sure it was good. And she's all excited about telling everybody. And she wanted me to let you know there's a vegetarian version. So she was so excited. So we got Reese tomorrow. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm going to tell you that right now, reminding myself of that necropsy, I'm feeling a little bit nauseous. That's a smell that won't leave you. It just won't leave you. So go ahead, recipe, whatever. I'll feel better tomorrow.
Karen just posted on Facebook, I love your stories, Jamie. Sorry to be amused by your suffering. But it's the way you tell them. You don't have to be sorry. I'm amused by her suffering. So you can just be amused right along with me, Karen.
All right, we
got the Budweiser Clydesdale trainer dude tomorow. How cool is
that? That's awesome. That's awesome. I came home from that job, Glenn. I came home my second day at work, and I told Chad what I had to do, and he goes, that's the day that when he said put the glove on, I would have said, thank you. It's been a pleasure working for you for a day and a half.
Yes. Have a nice day.
Have a nice day. See you later. If you missed the live show, you can listen to the recorded version on our website, affiliate websites, iTunes. You never need to miss an episode. Budweiser, Clydesdale commercial trainer, and Jessica Phoenix on tomorrow. Say goodbye, Glenn.
Bye, Glenn. Let me find the button. Hold on. I got to find the button. She has me laughing, so I'm falling off my ball.